People spend upwards of $250 billion per year on pills and potions they believe will help them avoid growing old. All that money leads us to ask, what can we feed our body to grow young again?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1238th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Firenze who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, we love the promise of pills and spend more on pills that promise longevity than any other, even though most of those pills are untested by scientific method. There are about 55,000 such longevity products on the market, and about half of us who live in North America supplement with at least one pill per day. The other way we try to live longer is by dieting. In one recent survey, 56% of women said they wanted to diet in order to live longer, though a recent meta-study of nearly 100 studies revealed that people in stage 1 obesity were only 5% more likely to die than those who were lean and mean. What can we do to live a longer life? While studies show that eating a lot of fruits and vegetables can cut mortality risk by roughly 23%, and exercising can cut the risk by 23%, the real key to longevity may not be in what you eat at all, or more likely, what you do with what you eat, but rather with whom you eat. And that single factor might reduce one's risk of mortality by upwards of 45%. And so today we pause to ask, what can we feed our body to grow young again? And here to help us find an answer, we have from France, Marta Zaraska, who is author of Growing Young: How Friendship, Optimism, and Kindness Can Help You Live to Be 100. That's a noble goal.
Yes, it is indeed. Thank you for inviting me today, Michael.
So pleased to have you back, Marta. When we last talked, we were talking about our obsession with meat. And so we wonder, how did you make this incredible leap from meat to longevity?
I mean, it's not a leap at all. I've been writing about nutrition and health and psychology for well over a decade now. And, you know, it's not that far away going from why do we love meat, which is about nutrition after all, to the ways we should be behaving to live long, which as I've discovered, is not that much about nutrition, but this was the starting point, you know, thinking how much we do obsess about nutrition and about what we eat and how we eat. So in a way, it was a natural step from meat hooks to growing young.
Well, do we obsess with what we eat because it's the one thing that's really easy to get a grip on?
I think so. You know, there are several reasons, I believe, why we are so focused on diets and miracle pills and miracle fruits and vegetables, goji berries, ancient grains, you name it. I think one of them is that we just like to have things that are easy to quantify. You know, we like to measure stuff. So it's very easy to say you're doing well because you've eaten your potions of kale for the day, you know, let's say the 100 grams or whatever ounces you need. We love to measure our steps. We love to measure our heart rate. We just like measuring stuff, basically. And the other stuff is that the things that we are so obsessing about are things that are being sold to us. So all the special foods and special diets and products and gadgets that will measure stuff. And when we are thinking about soft drivers of longevity, so exactly friendship, kindness, optimism, first of all, it's kind of hard to measure whether you're doing well on friendship, right? And second, there is really nobody who can sell you anything. They cannot sell you a walk with your friends. You know, there is no gadget there. There is no diet there. There is no pill there. So this is why this kind of gets off our radar.
And to bring it back on the radar, you wrote this book, Growing Young, and that's what we're going to do today. We're going to bring it back on the radar as best we can. And like to start with the three things that you really say make a difference. The first one is a committed romantic relationship.
That's correct. So you've said about some few numbers before. So you've mentioned that exercise and diet can lower our mortality risk somewhere between 20 and 30%, depending on a study. But that's more or less the ballpoint here. Whereas when we are talking about the committed and generally happy romantic relationship, this can lower your mortality risk by almost 50%. So this is much, much more than the best diet and exercise can do for you, which of course doesn't mean you should just completely give up on nutrition and exercise. It just shows you the perspective and how important those things are. And that's, of course, the best would be if you ate healthy and had a great romantic relationship. But, you know, that's if you were to choose only one somehow, then that would be a long-term loving relationship.
All things being equal, almost twice what everything else does for you. It's incredible. Almost 50%, 49% reduction in mortality. Through a long-lasting, caring relationship with somebody. Wow. The other thing was a large social network of family and friends.
That's correct. That's your second best bet. And again, studies show that people who are well socially connected, they not only live longer, but they have less cardiovascular disease, less diabetes, less cancer. Basically, everything you measure, they just come out better health-wise, you know. And on the other hand, social isolation or loneliness can be seen even on the level of your gene expression. So it can be really, really measured down to the most physiological responses of our bodies, basically.
And then the third thing, have a conscientious personality. What does that mean? A conscientious?
That basically means paying your bills on time, keeping your house and desk all tidy and being always on time, which may sound boring, but in fact is one of the biggest predictors of health and longevity. And it's not just because people who are conscientious tend to take their pills on time and visit doctor when they should and so on. There are actually biological reasons are underneath that too, because when scientists control for all this kind of healthy behaviors of conscientious people, there still remains a large chunk of the effect that's just basically down to our physiology.
Mm-hmm. And in Growing Young, you really take us there. And one of the places that really caught my attention was the relationship between the mind and the body. We often tend to think there are two different places, but they're really connected in some very interesting ways. You open that section by talking a little bit about the movie Manhattan, in which Diana Keaton asked Woody Allen to please let out your anger so that it can finally get things out in the open. But Woody Allen replies, "No, I don't get angry. I just grow a tumor." And there is that relationship between the mind and body. And if you hold things in, they eventually break out in bad ways. And you speak of the body having three reactions to external stimuli: the emotions, the feelings, and the thoughts. Let's play with those a little bit. First, I guess, comes emotions. Why is that?
So emotions are those more basic physiological bodily responses to what's happening outside. It's basically these are signal that tell you something about the state of your body and the environment. So emotion, for example, of anger, it tells you that, for example, maybe you are going to be punched soon, right? Or if there is emotion of disgust, tells you that maybe you stepped into something that's full of bacteria and parasites. So these are basically signals about the state of your environment. Then we get feelings, which are our mind's interpretations of those emotions. And all those things are very, very biological as well. These are not some kind of, you know, vapors in your body. What scientists can stimulate our emotions, basically evoke emotions and also to a lesser extent feelings, but by playing with our brains, basically by stimulating different parts of brain, they can cause emotions. So we can really see that these things are very biological. They are part of our nervous system, basically.
And it can even demonstrate that in animals as well, correct?
Exactly. We can also, they also react very similarly, especially when in terms of the emotions, so the kind of the signals about the state of their environment, they have very similar makeup to ours.
So we're walking through the forest, and a lion jumps out in our path. And so what happens is that we have this immediate emotional response that just zzz, like somebody put your fingers in a light socket or something. It's an immediate hit, and then we start feelings, and then we have the thoughts that come in at the end of this chain reaction, right?
I mean, it's all extremely connected to each other. So we have something that's called, it's going to be a mouthful. It's hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And this is basically the stress system that you have that reacts exactly to lions or to your boss calling you into his office. So things that are stressful, and there's our fight and or flight response. And it starts in the brain in several parts of it, like for example, hypothalamus. And then there is a chain reaction basically of different things turning on in your body, different glands activating and secreting various hormones, a soup of hormones that includes cortisol and then later on also adrenaline from a different system. And they all mix up to cause you this kind of reaction of stress that makes your muscles tense, your pupils dilate so you can see better, for example, or your bowels to empty so that you can flee faster. And all those systems, we still have them, and they activate as well to lions as they do to mortgage stress or to traffic jams and things like that. And when these reactions are prolonged, this is really bad for our body.
Well, you made a really interesting point there with respect to the different kinds of stress that we face. You know, we occasionally run into a lion in the forest, and that's one kind of stress, but it kind of goes away right away. Then there's the stress of the mortgage that doesn't seem to go away for 30 years.
Exactly, because we also have a system that also calms us down. And it's supposed to activate right afterwards the danger is gone, so where the lion, walks away, hopefully interested in something else. And we are supposed to calm down. There is, for example, vagus nerve, that's one, the longest nerve that emerges directly from our brain that takes part in it. And the problem is that when we have this kind of modern stresses that are like kind of low burning, maybe they're not as huge as the stress of a lion, but they're always there. The problem is that the whole system starts to malfunction basically, and this in long term causes us diabetes and cancer and heart disease because it's just not working the way it was supposed to. Our ancestors had very different problems, and their systems were designed for life on the savannah.
So it what Woody Allen said was really kind of true. I don't get mad, I just grow a tumor. And that's what happens
Exactly.
when you hold these things in for long periods of time. Well, when we come back, I'd like to know how the body goes about managing these forms of stress. And you provide four different ways. One of them talks about the 3 pounds of microbiome in our bellies. Oh my goodness. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we have Marta Zaraska with us all the way from France talking about growing young, how friendship, optimism, and kindness can help you live to be 100. And who doesn't want to live to be 100? Oh, come on, fess up. We all want to live to be 100. Except I'm afraid that they'll halt the aging process of cells at 90. Never mind. This is the Food Chain. Right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're talking about growing young. It's possible, or at least it's possible to extend how long we live. And ironically, it's not so much through what we eat, although that's what we always tend to think. We're always running around buying the newest, latest longevity capsule or pill or supplement or food, and they're always being offered up because, gosh, it's a great way to make money. Billions and billions and billions we spend on it every year. But Marta Zaraska says the real key is how we relate to the world. And it could be very simply as easy as finding the right mate, finding the right community, and finding the right way of interacting with that community. And so that's what we're exploring. And previously, before we went to the break, we were talking a little bit about how the body reacts to various forms of stress. There's the immense quick stress of meeting a lion in the woods, and the lion goes away and we settle back down. But what if the stress is a mortgage that takes 30 years to get rid of? And what do you do with that stress? Well, Marta, what do we do with all that stress?
I mean, hopefully the best way to deal with stress is to exactly find yourself a community of others, because this is how we evolved. We humans are social apes. And as I write in Growing Young, this is our perfect scenario to be with others, to be with the tribe, basically. Just like chimpanzees, for example, they are also a type of social ape. They thrive when they are surrounded with others. You don't see a chimpanzee living all on its own all alone. They just don't. And we are very similar. When we are with others, for example, we get lots of social hormones into our body, for example, endorphins. So when you see chimpanzees grooming each other, their bodies start releasing this hormone called hormones called endorphins, which on one hand make them feel all included and really bonded with each other. But on the other hand, they have very physiological effects as well. So, for example, they act as natural painkillers. And the same thing happens with us when you are with other people around you, when you are sitting with your friends, when you're holding hands with your loved one, when you're hugging a friend or your sister or brother, you also get the boost of those social hormones, endorphins included, that calm your stress and make you feel much better both emotionally and physically.
And what about the gut microbiome, of which we've been learning quite a bit lately? We're coming to the grips with the fact that there are 10 trillion little buggies living in us and on us. And how do they manage, what part do they play in the management of the stress that we live with?
I mean, so the microbes are also another way that connects our minds and our bodies. We often think of them just as, you know, staying there in the gut and being just part about nutrition and what we ingest and so on. But the truth is that they are also connecting with our brain through different things they secrete, for example. We are still trying to figure out exactly what are the processes here. Also, this vagus nerve that I mentioned before is likely also involved how the microbes in your gut communicate with your brain. And it is a two-way communication. So your brain influences the microbiome and the microbiome influences your brain. And the interesting thing is here that we actually exchange microbes with other people. So when you are playing contact sports, for example, one team will exchange microbes with the other team. Also, when you hug your friends also or your family members, you are all the time exchanging microbes with them. And it was interesting, for example, that research on mice or other rodents showed that we can also get personality through those microbes. So, for example, if you take a mice that has a very gloomy personality and you take her microbiome from her gut and transplant it to another mice, you can make the second mice gloomy as well, which is absolutely fascinating when you think about it. And also, you know, when you think about whether hugging very pessimistic people makes you pessimistic, we don't know that yet, so don't worry. But there is something in there, and certainly having a very diverse microbiome is very good for our health, and you get it also from other people, and you know, the more diverse, the better.
You talk about the vagus nerve. So let's back up a little bit about and take a little more descriptive of that nerve. As I understand it, it's kind of like a telegraph line between the brain and the rest of the body. Am I wrong?
I mean, it is the longest of the nerves that come out of your brain directly, and it's responsible for your breathing, for your digestion, for your swallowing. But also, interestingly, it's responsible for the mind-body connection as well. For example, it has been linked to sudden so-called voodoo deaths that have been found among tribes of Africa or the islands of the Pacific, when people get so suggested by, for example, the shaman of the tribe, that they did something very, very wrong, that from the pure shame and stress of it, they basically die.
Well, you told a wonderful story about voodoo death that really made it clear, and it was a person that was fed a chicken. Would you go through that one?
Yes, it was a story told about a young African living in, you know, it was in 19th century, I think, and in his tribe there was a taboo on eating chicken, and he visited someone else who fed him chicken but told him it was something else, and the young African, he ate it and he was perfectly fine, obviously. And then 2 years later, those two people met again, and the host told the young man that, you remember, you know, when you visited me that 2 years ago, you actually ate chicken. And he, because it was such a huge taboo in his tribe, he felt such an extreme stress that he basically collapsed and died.
And there's the voodoo death.
That's exactly what's, and most likely scientists now believe that this has something to do with this nerve, that the longest nerve, the vagus nerve, connecting our brains and our bodies.
And I guess, to me, one of the most obvious examples of that would be the impact of a placebo on somebody.
Yes, so, you know, the placebo effect is so amazing that In a way, even if we know that something is placebo, it still works amazingly. And the more something is medicalized, the more we think it works. So, for example, placebo is best when it's delivered by a doctor who is wearing a white coat, and an injection is better than a pill, because basically our minds connect it the way that the more something is serious, the more it will work. And to, you know, placebos work so well that, for example, 42% of balding men maintain or increase hair growth after a placebo cure. So just, you know, just from purely believing that it will work.
Wow. 42% just on a placebo, when there should be no reaction at all, there is a reaction. And that's exactly. Truly amazing. Well, what you've done in laying out this connection between the mind and the body is to lay the groundwork for what comes next, and that is the impact of everything else on our body and our longevity. And you next kind of pick up the notion of we are what we eat, but maybe not so much, because we really love chasing things that we think are going to increase our longevity, but there's really no scientific proof of that. True?
Yes, exactly. For example, you know, the famed omega-3 fatty acids, right? Everybody's talking about them. But on the other hand, you know, studies have found that there is basically no effects of those fatty acids on longevity. You know, just nothing really. Or turmeric, for example, it's turmeric. It's the famed, you know, everybody talks about it. Even I believed in it. I used to be obsessed about adding it to every single day, almost every single dish I was cooking. And yet, you know, it's something that scientists called pains, which is our chemical substances that fool scientists by pretending to work, basically, whereas it's just a fake effect, it's not real. But if you are not very careful, you can think something is happening where in fact there is nothing going on.
Kind of like fool's gold.
Exactly.
Well, another one that caught me was the obesity paradox.
Yes, that's right. So it's mostly about BMI-based obesity and how much we focused on it. And it's true that you were extremely obese, morbidly obese, that it will have effects on your health and longevity. But a little bit of extra pounds or kilograms, studies are not so certain. You know, there is quite a few of them showing that there is either no effect or even sometimes in some studies, people who are a little overweight actually come out better than people who are lean. So there is definitely something going on. Researchers are still checking what's going on, and I'm definitely not recommending anybody to gain weight, but it may not be as vital as we think, especially if we're just talking a few extra pounds.
Well, and with respect to the food that we do eat, what kind of food should we eat? You talk a little bit about an Arctic explorer and his discovery of what he called rabbit starvation.
Yes, that's right. That was so rabbit starvation is something that Arctic explorers have been seeing quite a lot in 19th century, and this is what happens when you're stranded in the north in the winter and you have nothing else to eat but very small lean animals, and they all tend to be lean in the winter, so rabbits, squirrels, that kind of thing. And the thing about them is that they're loaded with protein because they have extremely little fat. So, for example, a deer in the northern winter will still have some fat on it, but not a bunny or a squirrel. So, when you tend to eat so much protein, it causes basically protein poisoning. So, you have too much protein and it can damage kidneys, for example, and generally it's very bad for your health. So, this is an effect that they've been describing when exactly in the far north.
And you kind of compare that with the Rosetto effect of people who are eating what? 41% of their calories are from fat,
Yes,
which of
but
course is something we've all been taught is a no-no. You shouldn't have all that fat, though it tastes so good.
I mean, you still shouldn't do it. I mean, the fat was not doing anything good to people of Rosetto, but it was kind of amazing that it was not killing them left and right, and the reason for that was their social life. So Rosetta was I mean, it still is a town in Pennsylvania that was inhabited by people who immigrated there from a town called Rosetto in Italy. And back in the 1950s and 1960s, Rosetto really attracted attention of doctors because basically, nobody was having heart disease there, and nobody was dying of heart attacks, even though in neighboring towns, you know, it was just your American average. And they shared the same water supply, they shared healthcare, and yet Rosetto itself was very different. So, scientists obviously got curious and they started investigating what was so special about Rosetto. And exactly, it was not the diet, because the Italians somehow completely forgot their ancestral diet when they moved to Pennsylvania and started eating traditional, typical American diet, quite a bad one actually, the bad version of it, also with lots of alcohol and stuff. And it was not their genes either. It has been checked for. And so what the scientists finally figured out was that it was their social life. So people in Rosetto did bring from Italy their extreme focus on community and relationships. So they were always visiting each other. They were extremely neighborly. They were always having events that everybody participated in. They had 22 civic organizations in a town of 2,000 people. They were volunteering. They were really taking care of the town. So it was an extreme community spirit, and this is what really protected their cardiovascular health.
Now, was this town kind of an epiphany for you when you really started realizing what the true value of longevity might be?
I mean, it was definitely very interesting example, to the point that at some point actually I considered calling my book "Not Growing Young, but the Rosetto Effect," but my publisher thought it was maybe not a little too obscure. But definitely, it's a very fascinating place. And the problem with Rosetto, though, was that right now there is nothing going on there anymore. As scientists have predicted already back in the 1950s, is that if the Rosettans were to forget their ways and just go to the default to the American average. Also, their cardiovascular health would unfortunately default to American average. And this is exactly what happened. So the next generations basically went chasing the American dream. They moved to the suburbs. They bought bigger cars, started driving more, started working more, forgot about the community. And now they are just your average American, I mean, average Pennsylvanian town.
So kind of just disappeared. And I wonder if you see any of this in the Amish community as well. Have you read anything about that? Because they tend to be from big extended families, and they tend to have a very kind of a mellow way of approaching their life.
I mean, that's a very fascinating question, although I have to admit I haven't seen any studies on the Amish community. That doesn't mean they don't exist. I just haven't seen any.
Okay. So, and one quick one before we go to the break, and that's the gnawing parasite of loneliness.
Yes. Very bad for you.
I think what we should do is pick up the next segment with that, because we're just about to take a break here in another minute. But that's such an important point. Here it is. The gnawing, G-N-A-W, gnawing parasite of loneliness. Wow, that just does seem so terribly frightening. And that's what we're going to explore when we come back, and how it's overcome to live a long and fruitful and happy existence. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? With Martha Zaraska, author of Growing Young, How Friendship, Optimism, and Kindness Can Help You Live to Be 100. We did not get to the whole subject of supplements, but you kind of put that aside as saying not really the key. The real key is how we relate to our friends and our family and our community. And if you want to lead a real long life, stay tuned, because we're going to go to where they lived a real long life and learn how they did. This is the Food Chain. Right back. Do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. Metro Farm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson with Marta Zaraska, and we're talking a little bit about what it takes to live a long and happy and fruitful life. And it's not really found in the pills that we eat. Although you might find some marginal benefit from them, the real big benefit, 49%, find a nice mate and enjoy each other's company and enjoy a community of people around you and participate in that community. That's what really helps you live long. But now we're going to talk about this this gnawing parasite of loneliness. That sounds so frightening, Marta.
Because loneliness is frightening. It's a really big health problem, to the point that, you know, in the UK, they now have a ministry for loneliness, actually, in the government. They recognize really that this is not something that, you know, that's individual personal problem. It's actually a societal problem. It's something that even costs healthcare, and can count how much, right?
So there it is. If you don't figure out how to interact with the world, then chances are you're just going to fade away.
Yes, you know, people who are isolated or feeling lonely, they have, for example, different expression of genes that are involved in cancer, for example, in that promote cancer progression. They have shorter telomeres, so those protective caps at the ends of your chromosomes that have a very important role in aging. You know, they even have higher blood pressure. It's extremely biological, those effects of loneliness on your body.
So there you go. And you see them walking around, those people who, you know, don't have a community and don't have a career, don't have a job. And you can see them walking around. And I would be frightened to hug them, thinking maybe my microbiomes might be exchanging this with them. I don't know. So, but you did find a place that really exemplifies your whole concept of growing young again, and that, of course, is Japan, where the world's longest people live. Somehow they beat out Okinawa. How do they do that?
Yes, that's true. Okinawa is no longer the longevity epicenter of Japan. Actually, right now, it's the Nagano Prefecture, the one that hosted the Winter Olympics a long time ago. So very soon, probably, you'll start seeing books with, you know, the Nagano Diet or something like this in the title, no longer Okinawa. So this is where people in Japan live the longest right now. And this is the very mountainous area. And one of the reasons that even the health government of Nagano actually recognizes that is the reason for particular longevity of people there is their purpose in life and the fact that they keep being active after retirement much more than people in other parts of Japan.
So Nagano being a mountainous, is that around Mount Fuji by any chance?
I mean, it's a little bit kind of close, but it's more into the center of the islands than Mount Fuji. It's around the town called Matsumoto, more or less there. This is the epicenter of longevity zone of Japan right now.
And so their food isn't really any different. I mean, they're not close to the coast then, so they don't really focus a lot on seafood, do they?
Not really. I mean, they still eat quite a lot of vegetable and so on. But, you know, when I was traveling there for researching Growing Young, I was kind of disappointed, actually, because I was expecting also this, you know, outdoor food market selling all this amazing, you know, local delicious organic foods. But there was nothing like this. I just found supermarkets with, you know, vegetable wrapped in plastic. It was kind of sad. But you could really see the community spirit there, though. I really saw, you know, how much they care for this, for example, the centers of their villages, or for the public services, the public areas, everything. You know, it's really the spirit there that you can really feel it.
So then that really was a good example of what you're talking about, because it wasn't the food, because there was nothing special about the food. It was vegetables wrapped in plastic at the big box store, just like the rest of us in the world have to contend with. So couldn't have been the food. What did you first see that about the people? You talked about a little park and just, yeah. Tell us about that park. It was a sweet, sweet observation.
I mean, it was a little village in Japan where actually they have men there lived the longest in the whole Japan. It's a very small town, but it had a little central square, and it was amazing. It was just so perfectly cared for. You know, everything was so clean. I went to a public toilet there, and there not only it was sparkling, but there were actually fresh flowers in the vase, you know, on the countertop in a public toilet, and there were just lots of people of different ages walking, sitting together, you know, kids playing completely on their own, and older ladies biking to the library. It was just a really good feel that, you know, this public services, this kind of something for everybody was really there. You know, it was just this kind of central area with something for everyone.
Well, those of us who have been to a public restroom don't recognize what you talked about. It can't possibly be a clean public restroom, and especially none with flowers in them, because that's just outside the job description of the public, you know, employees union. So it's not going to happen. But it does happen in this little village in Japan. And so who's doing the cleaning? Who's doing the public service?
So this is the fascinating part. So in Japan, they have something called silver hair jobs. And by silver hair jobs, they mean jobs are done by people who are already past retirement age and generally retire from their original careers, but decide to pick up simple jobs, very undemanding kind of intellectually, usually part-time, and just to do something for the community mostly. So you even have silver hair employment agencies where a person who is, let's say, 65 can go, and you can find, you know, high-powered managers or bankers going there, and they ask for jobs like, for example, parking attendant or public garden, you know, gardener or something like this, or exactly as somebody who puts flowers in the public toilet. And they actually want it. They want to do it, not for the money. I talked to many of those people and they said, we don't do it for money. I do it for the feeling of being useful, the feeling of participating still in life, of doing something for the community. And this is something that Japanese people consider completely normal, and actually they think that this benefits their health longevity too. And the research does confirm that being involved after retirement, it doesn't have to be, you know, a parking attendant job, but just doing something actively for others is actually extremely important.
And there's a name for it.
Yes, the Japanese call it the ikigai, so the reason for living. And they usually, when they talk about ikigai, they say things like, my ikigai is my children, or my ikigai is my job, or ikigai is my volunteering for my local library, or something like that. So just usually involves some kind of giving back to the community.
Wow. And then there is the five house rule.
Yes, that's another thing I really found helpful. So it was very clear. So the Japanese, of course, they also very much believe in the power of community and your neighborhood and how that it's importance for your health. And they say that you should follow the five house rule, which basically means that you should be close friends with people who live in two houses on both sides of your house, so to the left and to the right, and in three houses in front of your house. So then you have five neighbors with whom you should have really close relationship.
And I suppose that's a lot easier to do in a small village in Japan than in Tokyo.
I mean, certainly, you know, there is also a darker side of the Japanese social life, and we may see the negative effects of this in the future, that people are becoming more isolated. that people have problems, with relationships. There are so many single people in Japan who never marry, who never have children, who still live alone. And the researchers are saying that we, in the future, they're actually worried about, the longevity of Japanese nation in the future, because the people who are living so long right now, who are making the numbers and the statistics, are those who lived in Japan who are still following more of those traditional values, the, very community engaged, and, the people who are retiring now and taking those silver hair jobs, right? But the young people, a lot of them don't follow the same values, and this may unfortunately impact the longevity of the Japanese nation in the future.
Sliding down the slippery slope of modern times, right?
Yep, unfortunately.
And is that something that, it seems like that's something that almost all modern times nations are facing. Children who are raised alone on video games and don't get to interact with other children. I wonder, have you seen any studies on the impact of video games and what happens to all those wonderful endorphins, or do they get the endorphins from the video games?
I mean, you can't. You have to have contact with real humans. And, even studies show, for example, that when you text message other people, you don't get the same boost of the oxytocin hormone, so the love hormone, that you get from a traditional phone call. So we are not even talking about Zooming or Skyping with video call, just, picking up the landline and calling. So hearing the voice makes a whole difference for your actual hormones in your body. So we can only imagine that, video games are just like texting or even worse, right?
And there it is. Now, one of the toughest ones that you came up with that I think is very important, but probably is kind of difficult to really describe, and that is the Zen, finding the Zen. What do you mean by finding the Zen?
I mean, so it's mostly about mindfulness in meditation, and we hear about these things a lot, and they are important for our health as well. Although I always say that the other parts I've mentioned before are actually more important. So if your marriage, your friendships, your community, your ikigai, this purpose in life, are actually more important than mindfulness. So if you were just to pick one of those things, then don't choose mindfulness as the first strategy. But it is good for you. It's definitely, calms out all the stress systems that we have in our body. It's, scientists, for example, scan the brains of people who are long-term meditators, they can actually see changes in various brain regions, and some meditators even breathe differently, and they even blink differently than people who don't meditate, which are all indicators of a less stressed body.
And a less stressed body has the opportunity to last a lot longer than a stressed body. And that's what we've been learning here today. We started off by talking about the three things that really bring longevity, and I'd like to go back to them. But first, the notion that it's not in the pills, it's not really in the food, although you have to eat right. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yes, exactly. So healthy diet is important, but it's far simpler than we often think. You really don't have to chase the newest, fanciest miracle foods. Just simple carrots, apples, these kind of things are perfectly fine as long as you get your veggies. And just like Michael Pollan said, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. That's it. It's very simple. We don't have to really obsess about it, so that it leaves us time to follow the soft drivers of longevity, the friendship, the relationships, the community, that are at least as important, if not more.
Well, if you look at the percentages you quote, there are a lot more. And you start with a committed romantic relationship. Risk reduces the risk of mortality by 49%. That's huge.
It is huge. It's actually, bigger than eating six or more servings of fruits and vegetables a day.
There you go. A large social network of family and friends reduces mortality by 45%.
Yep, that's correct. So that's, that's your second best bet if you want to go for long and healthy life.
And then again, have a conscientious personality. reduces mortality by 44%. Conscientious, what do you mean?
So, you know, paying your bills on time, arriving at meetings on time, keeping your house tidy, all these kind of things, which may sound very boring, but in fact are extremely important for health, to the point that, you know, if you could ingest conscientiousness in a pill, it would be actually a miracle drug, because its effects are bigger than those of aspirin on reducing cardiovascular disease. So these are really, really big effects. And it's not just because conscientious people tend to visit doctors when they should and take all the pills they should when they're prescribed and so on and so on. But when scientists control for all those behaviors, there is still a large chunk remaining of the effect that is most likely due to just pure physiological, biological effects.
What's the most important thing that we should be doing to help live a long, healthy, and happy life?
Just be connected to other people, you know, pay attention to your relationships. We really often forget about how important they are, and or even think about them just in terms of, you know, our mental health, our happiness. But it's not just about mental health. It's about your physical health as well. So, for example, before I wrote Growing Young, I often thought that if I skipped my runs, I like to run, and if I skipped a run to just sit on a couch with my husband, that was kind of okay, it was very nice for reconnecting, but it was bad for my physical health because I was, you know, I was not running, right? But right now I see it as
a physical,
as important physical health, exactly, as a health behavior as well.
Oh, and there you know, you go. And Marta Zaraska, we just ran out of time, but go, not with you, girl. We'll be able to live a long and healthy life by picking up a copy of Growing Young. Marta Zaraska, thank you so much for joining us from Paris, or no, from France. What a wonderful place to be today. Thank you, Marta.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.